Hello and welcome to Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I am Tom Castles. Thanks again for joining us on another bi-weekly episode of the Databook podcast. We are a podcast of healthcare analytics news. You can visit us at hcanews.com.
So we have a really good episode for you today. It's about regulations in healthcare's changing digital landscape. And to explore that topic, we are going to bring on Dr. Barak Richman. He's a law professor at Duke University, just put out a really interesting article in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So we try to bring you some amazing stories here on the Databook podcast. So if you enjoy them, be sure to rate, subscribe, and review. And again, visit us on hcanews.com and check us out on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
To get a feel for the moment that we're in right now, let's take a trip back in time.
That's something that we tend to do a lot here on Databook, and that's because we can really learn a lot from these inflection points, whether they're from healthcare or any other industry that has undergone or tried to undergo a digital evolution.
Indeed. Now first, some quick background. When I interviewed Barak Richman, I asked him which story he thought would be just right for this episode. I figured he would talk about HIPAA or some long ago regulatory change that I hadn't even heard of.
But Dr. Richman came back with something that was a little bit more recent, and it was kind of a surprise.
It was surprising because this story, or at least part of it, was right under our noses.
We report on this story and its consequences almost every day in some way.
It's a tale that contributed to the nearly universal adoption of electronic health records.
It's a tale that led to tens of billions of dollars in expenditures. It led to the launch of hundreds of health information exchanges. And of course, as many of these events do, it led to harsh criticism, great praise, and even some hope.
Today on Databook, we are bringing you the creation of the position that helped put health tech, data sharing, and interoperability on the map.
The National Coordinator for Health Information Technology.
So if you're listening to this podcast, you probably already know of the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, and you probably know it as ONC. But before we dive in, here is a quick refresher.
The ONC is part of the Department of Health and Human Services. It's led by the National Coordinator. And at the moment, that just happens to be Dr. Don Rucker.
So the National Coordinator is basically the point person for all things health IT across the government and even into the private sector. The ONC is all about promoting data sharing, interoperability, healthcare innovation, all the things that we love here on Databook.
Yes, indeed. It's about better care, better outcomes, lower costs, and engage patients and populations.
So the ONC holds conferences, it works with health IT innovators regarding technical standards, individual projects, it issues certifications, it does strategic planning, it does it all.
And regardless of what any of us may think of its progress, the ONC just tries to make this whole health IT thing work.
And the National Coordinator for Health IT has been doing this for a long time, since all the way back in 2004.
At the dawn of the new millennium, people are really amazed by the rise of the internet. Not just people, it's governments too, businesses, really, you name it. All of a sudden, this technology that some had considered a trend is proving to be the real deal. The internet and computers are not going anywhere.
And by the early 2000s, electronic health records are also entering the clinic. They had been for quite some time.
But EHR adoption is seriously limited. Select providers use them only in very certain ways, and they're still sort of a long-term pipe dream.
But the apparent staying power of the internet is changing how people think of EHRs. They're beginning to seem like something that healthcare can implement, and maybe sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and there's good reason to believe that. Other countries are already building out health IT infrastructure. They're really making strides, and the US is unfortunately kind of lagging behind.
So it's one thing to want to catch up and even surpass other nations when it comes to tech, but that desire for pride and progress alone is not what drives our growing interest in EHRs and health IT.
The catalysts are real needs. First, health plans and other stakeholders think they can save money by using EHRs and the exchange of health data. and political leaders, they see this as an opportunity to cut wasteful healthcare spending.
Then there's the clinical side. You see, during this time, preventable medical errors and wild treatment variations are very much in the spotlight. Clinicians are sort of resistant to the EHR by and large, kind of like how some of them are today even, but they often don't have the best treatment information at their fingertips, which limits care.
Industry groups and researchers come to find that EHR systems could sharply reduce medical errors, which cause anywhere from 45,000 to 98,000 deaths every single year.
With statistics like that, the idea of a personal health record begins to seem very appealing, and for other reasons too. Patients and their advocates want more choice, more empowerment, and want things to be easier.
All of a sudden, widespread adoption of the EHR begins to look like the answer.
Now it is April 26, 2004. In a speech, President George W. Bush unveils several new high-tech initiatives, including one for healthcare.
Within 10 years, every American must have a personal electronic medical record, he says.
Wow, that's a good presidential voice.
I tried to do a President W. Bush impression, but we had to cut that, so sorry, guys. So Bush goes on and says that the federal government has got to take the lead in order to make this happen by developing what's called technical standards.
I can feel the power. I can feel it. But the next day, Bush signs an executive order creating the position of National Coordinator for Health IT.
So the idea is that this digital connected vision of healthcare absolutely cannot work without some common ground. Government healthcare groups like the CMS, the VA, OPM, and then private health systems and providers can pull off the EHR and data exchange only if there's some connective tissue between them.
It's kind of similar to the intelligence and defense agencies. As tech evolved over there, the nature of their work did too, and they needed a link, so they built some cooperative groups, and that's what needed to happen in healthcare.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the National Coordinator for Health IT is supposed to do.
So in May 2004, Bush appoints this guy called Dr. David J. Brailer to the position. He has been hanging around the administration as an unofficial healthcare advisor, and now he is the point person for a new mission, for a new hope for medicine.
And in some sense, the National Coordinator for Health IT is a walking acknowledgement, a sort of reaction to this fundamental change in healthcare.
So the years pass and eventually Congress mandates the office of the National Coordinator in the High Tech Act.
The ONC is responsible for building a secure and interoperable health IT system. It takes on meaningful use, meaning it's vetting EHR systems and hospitals' adoption of them.
The High Tech Act also brings billions of dollars in incentives for more EHR adoption.
And now, of course, physicians are still very wary, but there's not really a choice about whether to go digital anymore.
And EHR adoption skyrockets. In 2008, less than 10% of acute care hospitals had a basic EHR system even. But by 2015, almost all of them had a certified EHR. And today, it is really, really difficult to find any provider who doesn't use an EHR.
But through seven different national coordinators for health IT and then three different presidential administrations, there's still so much work left to be done.
Particularly when it comes to usability, interoperability.
And the ONC remains on the front lines.
So we bring up this story today because healthcare is still going through some high-tech growing pains. And our guest, Dr. Barack Richman, just published a perspective in the New England Journal of Medicine describing one of these problems. The article is called Health Regulation for the Digital Age, Correcting the Mismatch, and it details the disconnect between laws governing healthcare regulation and the cutting-edge devices and therapeutics that are changing the industry. It all adds up to a lot of confusion and some real consequences. So Barack Richman is the Edgar P. and Elizabeth C. Bartlett Professor of Law and Business Administration at Duke University. He has a long history in healthcare and has argued before the mighty U.S. Supreme Court. He's got a PhD, a JD, an MA, very well-educated guy. So, Barack Richman, thank you so much for joining us today on Databook.
No, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start off by asking you, what are the absolute most problematic parts of our regulatory framework today as it pertains to digital health?
I think the biggest issue is that we continue to think of healthcare as being delivered by people as opposed to systems. And this is a problem that I think predated a lot of the digital technologies, but we still license individuals to be physicians and to be nurses, and we license individuals and physical facilities to be the deliverers of care. And we've known for a long time that the best healthcare systems involve teams, involve uses of data, involve mobilization of communities, involve the dissemination and exercise of information and information sources, and none of those really are reflected in our regulatory system. So the biggest issue is actually something that has stymied healthcare delivery regulation for a long time, even before digital technologies emerged. It's the false narrative that only people practice medicine.
So let's crack open the shell a little bit more to get at what you mean. In what ways do these legal, these kind of philosophical shortcomings hurt patients and healthcare providers on the ground?
That's a great way to ask the question, because these regulations are hurting patients and are stymieing providers. We're not talking about a takeover by robots or a dawn of the machines. We're just talking about an outdated regulatory system. One very simple example is that it's very difficult to get healthcare advice from a provider, whether it's over the phone or over FaceTime, from another state. There are enormous possibilities in telemedicine, something as simple as getting a diagnosis for an eye infection or a sore throat, something that needs no more than an antibiotic regimen. But if we want to utilize these telemedical technologies, we still have to comply with state-based licensure regimes. So if I'm in North Carolina and I want to hook up with a telemedical provider, I can only do that with another telemedical provider in North Carolina. And that's entirely anachronistic. There's no reason why a phone call to somebody in South Carolina should be treated differently from a phone call to someone that is just a couple miles away in the same state. And these are regulations that stymie the development of these new products. And when they do that, they limit what providers can do. They limit the kind of innovations they can offer. They limit the flexibility of their practices. And they also limit the introduction of valuable products and services that patients would really enjoy.
So in your article, you write about the need to tailor regulatory policy to the needs of digital medicine. For example, you note that mobile medical apps are neither medical devices nor hospital EHR systems, and regulation is compromised by treating them as either one. Can you elaborate on what a better regulatory system would look like?
So there's both a specific point there and a generic point. The generic point, I think, is more powerful. The way the law works, and this is not just health law, the way the law works is it establishes generic, generalizable rules, usually relying on general categories, and it applies these old categories to new sets of facts. So, for example, if we're trying to regulate cars, automobiles, you might think that the laws of tort, the laws of accidents law that were first applied to these cars were laws that were applied to horses, because that was the most analogous category when all of a sudden these horseless carts started to move around. Now, sure enough, the law of horses could apply to the law of cars, and maybe you get some reasonably good outcomes that way. Maybe you avoid certain kinds of accidents. Maybe you can manage certain traffic patterns by relying on this old law. But ultimately, if you really want a regulatory framework that accommodates the widespread use of cars, that facilitates the use of cars, that helps people understand what their obligations are when they drive cars, you need to update the law. And that's where we are in medicine. We still have these old categories, And we're applying them to new technologies. And sometimes they work okay. Sometimes they work in the short run. But they always have limits. And the biggest question is we should be forward thinking. We should, if we want to utilize effectively these new technologies, we have to think about the right regulatory framework that would nurture them and channel them appropriately. The specific example that you mentioned just involves digital apps. Right now, there are two concurrent regulatory frameworks at work right now. We have the FDA that regulates medical devices, and we have CMS that regulates electronic health systems. FDA tends to look towards concerns of safety, and CMS tends to look towards concerns of privacy. And obviously, these new digital apps introduce concerns both for safety and privacy, but the way current law deals with those challenges is you have two different agencies with two different capabilities, and trying to fit them into regulatory categories that really don't fit. So if we really think that digital apps can be useful, albeit introducing concerns about safety and privacy, we really have to think about what they are and what kind of appropriate regulatory framework would help them. The analogy would be we shouldn't use the law of horses to govern cars, and we shouldn't use the law of medical devices to govern digital apps.
So there does seem to be some movement in Washington toward changing the framework. Like you look at the FDA's software pre-cert program, other initiatives that are in the news lately. Can you tell me what the FDA or lawmakers are doing right?
Well, you're exactly right. I commend a lot of what the FDA is doing. And this is not intended to be a critique of the FDA as an institution nor of its leadership. But what the FDA is constrained to do, because it is an agency that's governed by laws, is it has to look at these things within existing frameworks. So they are working very hard to apply their current frameworks and current procedures to evaluate the efficacy of software programs and digital apps. And they're doing a commendable job. But there's a limit as to what they can do if, number one, they have to coordinate with other agencies that are hardwired in very different ways, CMS being one. You might even think that Department of Labor and other parts, other agencies have some kinds of concurrent jurisdictions that would stymie what the FDA is trying to do. And they are limited in how forward-thinking they can be. I mean, when their mandate is to approve things that are trying to get onto the market, and they do it within a world that is designed to govern something else, like medical devices, it's very hard for them to feel comfortable charting out a future and trying to set up standards that could have some real benefit to the marketplace, things like interoperability and safety standards and technological standards. If they were given more statutory direction, more statutory authority, for example, then the FDA could really carve out a comprehensive regulatory framework that could help nurture these technologies in ways that would help patients and help providers.
So I'd like to pivot toward your vision for a better tomorrow. You argue that we ought to consider focusing less on medical malpractice and more on enterprise or product liability. You talk about improving training, improving payment models. So can you paint us a picture of the ideal tomorrow when it comes to this sort of regulatory framework?
So that's a harder question. The questions over approving digital apps, whether it's under the jurisdiction of CMS or of the FDA, that's a much more minor problem than these other foundational problems. The bigger issues actually involve issues of state law, involving the law of malpractice, of tort liability, and involving the law of licensure. These are laws that really were designed for a different kind of healthcare delivery system, not even the one we have now, let alone the one that we will have or hope to have in 10 years. Those are areas that really require a different orientation. So what could one possibility be? Now, licensure law is state-based law. They're governed by medical boards, actually not just medical boards. They're governed by dental boards and other professional boards. Bar associations govern the licensure regimes for lawyers, for example. And they, again, they build off of this paradigm, this traditional narrative that individuals are the ones that provide these professional services instead of teams that are organized around entities and organized around technologies, including certain automated technologies. And what we really would need to do is need to think where the future of healthcare delivery is going. And then second, how do we come up with a regulatory structure that assures quality without stymieing the kind of creativity that these professionals have? Maybe the best way to think about it is to go to the very origins of these regulatory bodies. There was a time around the end of the 19th century where medical doctors and medical schools, and I put those in air quotes, were popping up all over the place. And there was a sense that there were a lot of people who were deeply unqualified, who were offering guidance that was really antithetical to what science had already proven to be true. And they were walking around projecting themselves as doctors. And the states came together, or I should say the states cooperated with the medical leaders at the time. They set up regimes that prevented these unqualified doctors from hitting the marketplace. So you could think of this as a regulatory reaction to the prevailing challenge of the time. The prevailing challenge of the time is to make sure that only people who truly had some kind of scientific knowledge were able to present themselves as physicians. That's not the prevailing science, that's not the prevailing policy challenge right now. The prevailing challenge right now is to figure out how to harness the scientific technologies that we have and use them to pursue population health strategies. The challenge is not to make sure that an individual patient who is meeting with someone who purports to be an individual doctor actually is meeting with someone with certain requisite scientific knowledge. The challenge instead is to figure out how healthcare systems and networks of healthcare information and networks of insurance provisions can harness themselves to meet with the population health needs in a much broader sense. What we really need, in fact, is to move away from the one-on-one paradigm, the individual doctor being the individual provider of healthcare services. And if we stay in that paradigm, we're really going to be locking ourselves into an inferior technology. So what does the future look like? We have to ask ourselves where healthcare technologies are going, how we can improve quality and reduce cost. And this is the kind of things that people have been thinking about a lot, how we move to payment for value, how we move to population health strategies. And once we have a good idea of what that's going to look like, and I think we do, then we have to address the regulatory challenges and ask ourselves the foundational question, how should we assure quality? What would be the ideal regulatory framework if we were to start from scratch? And I can say with great confidence, it would not be the regulatory regime that we have right now.
Dr. Barak Richman, thank you for joining us on Databook.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So that does it for another episode of Databook.
If you like this healthcare analytics news podcast, please remember to rate, subscribe, review, share with a friend, and visit us online at hcanews.com.
HCA News has all of its own social media handles, and I'm just going to tout this as well. Jack has his own Twitter, if you guys didn't know.
Oh, wow. So do you, Tom.
It's at Jack Murtha.
We're actually in a competition right now to see who can get the most followers, so come to Team Jack.
Well, Team Tom just has a nice alliterative ring to it, so I would recommend Team Tom, guys.
On that note, it's going to do it for this episode of Databook. I am Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Kasmus.